You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. 62-year-old peace activist Faith Fiffinger was one of 200 or so volunteers from more than 25 countries who chose to live in Baghdad during the recent U.S. bombing campaign. Calling herself a human shield, she went with the mission of protecting civilian sites from attack by U.S. and British forces. She lived amongst average Iraqi citizens, visited hospitals and schools, and did whatever little thing she felt she could do to assist the people during the war. But when she returned to her home in Sarasota, Florida, after the war ended, a letter from the U.S. Treasury Department awaited her. Fiffinger and fellow peace activist Ryan Clancy were charged with working with the Iraqi government and were told they could face up to 12 years in prison and a $1 million fine for their actions. Peace Watch reached Fiffinger earlier today, and we began by asking her exactly what it was she did as a human shield.
After we made our decision where we wanted to go, we wrote to Bush in the White House to tell him exactly where we were going to be. And I arrived February 20th. I chose to stay at the Dawura oil refinery, which burned for 45 days after being bombed in 1991. I chose this site not only because of the humanitarian reasons determined by the UN, but because it also had a community of about 400 homes for refinery workers and their families, a school, a nursery, a market, a mosque, a clinic, a community in which I could and did become actively involved, particularly in the nursery and the elementary school, since I'm a retired teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And the first missile came over the house that I was in the community where I was living about 5:30 in the morning on March 19th. And I've never heard anything like that before. I've never been in that situation before. Hearts pounded, and I guess the worst part of it was knowing that when it landed, it was probably going to be killing someone. And it went on, seemed like it was endless. I remember thinking, is this ever going to stop? But when there was a pause and the all clear would sound, we would race out of our house to check to see if our neighbors were all right. Or we would run to the roof of our house to see what we could see. And it seemed like just when we were catching our breath, the bombing would start all over again and again and again and again. One unusually quiet day during the bombing, I did chance a visit to Hala Hospital, where 140 survivor casualties of an American bomb blast which hit their community far from any military installation were brought. These included men, women, and children of all ages with missing legs, missing arms, head wounds, and chest wounds. It included parents whose children had been killed, children whose parents had been killed, wives whose husbands had been killed, husbands whose wives had been killed. I spent the day going from bed to bed, witnessing the horror, the pain, and the torment of innocent victims of war. And when I got to the last room, there was a man standing, weeping, next to his dying wife, having also just lost his six children who had been killed in the blast. And he managed to ask where I was from. And of course, with tears streaming down my face, I answered, America. Anyway, when the U.S. military with their tanks and helicopters finally arrived at the site that I was on and secured the site, so to speak, I went to a civilian hospital in Baghdad to volunteer. I have no medical training, but under the circumstances, I knew they would probably need as much help as they could get.
And for these actions, the U.S. government is bringing fines against you. What have you actually been charged with, and what potential penalties do you face?
Yes, well, when I returned from Iraq, after having spent time as a volunteer in a civilian hospital as well, waiting for me from the Department of Treasury, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, was a requirement to furnish information which stated that criminal penalties for violating the regulations of sanctions range up to 12 years in prison and $1 million in fines, and that civil penalties of up to $270,000 per violation may be imposed administratively by OFAC. I had 20 working days in which to answer their questions concerning why I was in Iraq, what I did there, any financial transactions, and things like that. I did comply. I sent my reply, which was about 5 pages, to them in the time allotted. I didn't hear for anything for a while, and just it's a week or 2 weeks ago, I received a telephone call from them saying that if I would agree to a quick settlement, agreeing to whatever they said, that the penalty could be $10,000, and that if I chose to ignore that, they would send another penalty notice, which I assume would have perhaps stiffer conditions in it, and that if I chose to ignore that, that they could garner my Social Security and my paycheck, which of course is a retirement check, and any other assets which I might have.
Faith, knowing what you know now, and having the government, this government, come down on you, pressuring you, threatening to garnish your Social Security check and your retirement wages, and threatening to imprison you, would you choose to do that over again, be a human shield?
Yes, I would. Very much so. I have a humane caring for life on Earth, and a real desire to decrease rather than increase suffering. I believe in Gandhian principles of nonviolence, and I have to say I'm traumatized by all the needless loss of life. The tears that I shed each day are not just for the dying innocent Iraqi children that I held when I volunteered in the hospital, but they're also for our own military children who are dying every single day for what I consider to be a lie. And under these circumstances, yes, I would do the same thing again.
You're being charged or punished for, quote, working with the Iraqi government. Is there any truth in that allegation?
No, there isn't. I never went there with any intention of supporting the evil regime that was there, that was already devastating their people. And I might say that for a number of years did have support from the United States government. I had no intention of supporting that. My concern, as I said, was about stopping the war that I perceived as an illegal war, and protecting, standing by, innocent civilians, innocent people, just like you and me, my neighbors, my family, my friends, you know, innocent people not wanting to suffer, just wanting to be happy, just like us.
Are you, to your knowledge, the only peace activist that's traveled to Baghdad who has been singled out or received a fine?
To my knowledge, I have heard of others who have received similar, but as far as the human shields go, there are only two of us that I know of.
Do you think you're being sort of picked on unusually?
Well, there is a sense of being singled out, but I have to say that my concern is not really about what my government plans to do with me. My concern is about what my government is doing to my country with our foreign policy and our domestic policy and with our values and ideals that we once had. So whether I'm being specifically picked out or not, maybe doesn't matter.
Faith Fippinger, at various stages in the past, several members of the Chicago-based group Voices in the Wilderness have received similar penalty letters from the OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets and Control, for their humanitarian missions in Iraq, but those threats never really amounted to anything. How serious do you think the government is in pursuing your case and the case of your fellow peace activist, Ryan Clancy?
I'm really not sure. And I must say, at this time in our history, with the Patriotic Act and a number of other things, I really, really don't know. I go day by day. I would like to think that our government, you know, would appreciate that as an American, I did say to anyone who asked why this war, I did admit that I was American, which was very difficult to do. But I would think our government would want people, and particularly Iraqi people, to see and to know that our country, the United States of America, has concerned, caring people who want peace, happiness, and gentleness for our fellow beings. And so I guess, getting back to your question, I just have no idea whether they're going to carry through with this or if they're just trying to frighten or, you know, what, how much further they're going to carry this.
Faith, if you do happen to receive a large fine and a possible prison sentence for your actions, and of course we hope and pray that that won't happen, are you prepared to face the consequences?
I've thought about this a lot. I've thought about what would be accomplished if I were to take these fines or go to jail, but perhaps in some way it would cause people to really think about war and peace, justice and injustice, and the interconnectedness of all beings. And so I guess I have to say I'm prepared for whatever consequences might come.
Faith Fippinger is a 62-year-old retired teacher and peace activist who lives in Sarasota, Florida. Along with fellow Human Shield Ryan Clancy, she recently received a letter from the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control threatening her with up to 12 years in prison and $1 million fine. She wrote back that she is unwilling to pay the fine and is currently awaiting further correspondence from the government. In a show of measured progress, the U.S. and North Korea made their first direct contact contact in 4 months today on the sidelines of a summit aimed at furthering Pyongyang's nuclear disarmament. Tensions have been rising since October when North Korean officials admitted to U.S. Assistant Secretary of State James Kelly that they had, in fact, restarted their nuclear program after previous denials. We end today's show with Vietnam veteran and renowned peace activist Brian Wilson, who spoke recently in Los Angeles about the history of U.S. intervention in Korea and its implications for today. He starts by recalling how his perceptions of the situation were changed.
And then I read I F. Stone's The Hidden History of the Korean War, simply about the years 1950 and 51, talking about the fraud involved by the United States government in orchestrating its intervention into Korea in a manner that was not presented honestly to the American people or to the world or even to the United Nations in June of 1950. So I started reading more about the history of Korea and the history of the United States' involvement in Korea. First of all, you know, we flew Syngman Rhee from the United States to Korea in September 1945 to be our titular leader of the South Korean people after we divided the country in August of 45, after the Japanese surrender, who had occupied Korea for 40 years. So I started getting more and more into Korea, kept going to Korea, both north and south, talking to many people, speaking at many rallies about the emerging history I was learning about U.S. involvement in Korea. And after reading I.F. Stone's book, I had read several other books, including Bruce Cummings, John Holliday, and others, who started unraveling the make-believe version of what I had been taught about Korea. So as I started unraveling this history, I discovered that the United States had tried to get into Korea in 1866. They wanted to break open the Hermit Kingdom for trade. They sent the General Sherman ship up the Taedong River towards Pyongyang, had asked the Korean customs station for permission to go up the river, and they were denied permission, and they went up anyways. And subsequently, that ship with its 20-some crew were killed, and the ship was burned. In 1871, with two warships and 20 other naval vessels and 1,000 Marines and sailors, went to the western side of Korea, the Kangwa beaches, to avenge the insult to the U.S. flag committed by the Koreans against the General Sherman. There were 650 Koreans killed, and one U.S. sailor was killed. And even though we destroyed five Korean forts and 650 Korean people, we decided that we weren't welcome enough to continue any further in Korea, and we left. However, that was the largest U.S. military intervention in the entire 19th century outside of Canada and Mexico. In 1882, the United States signed a friendship agreement with Korea to facilitate some kind of trade, and we promised Korea that we would protect its sovereignty. Well, with the beginning of the Sino-Japanese War in 1894 and on, the Japanese became much more interested in occupying Korea, and in 1905, at the conclusion of the Russo-Japanese War, Japan actually physically occupied Korea continuously until their surrender in World War II on August 14th. Now, there were many uprisings in Korea against the Japanese in the 1890s and throughout the first 40 years of the 20th century in the occupation. The Koreans had to change their language to Japanese. They had to change their haircuts and dress to Japanese, their religion. They had to at least learn Shinto. So they were not allowed to actually be Koreans. Korea has a 5,000 history of unified culture. There's no minorities in Korea. It's a very homogenous culture. And when Japan surrendered August 14, 1945, the Koreans celebrated through the entire peninsula. There was, of course, no North South Korea. And by September 6th, the Koreans had reorganized in all the provinces and met in Seoul and created the new Republic of Korea. On September 8th, 2 days after the Koreans had announced their independence, the U.S. troops landed in Incheon. Under U.S. General Order No. 1, issued by General MacArthur, as the prerogative of the victors of World War II. Of course, the Koreans were not consulted about this. And since September 8, 1945, the U.S. troops have never really left South Korea. Russian troops were in the north until 1948. They left and have never been back, and were not welcome, quite frankly. Some of you may know about the Jeju Uprising in 1948, the big island part of Korea at the southern tip of the peninsula, in which somewhere between 30 and 50,000 were killed of the 300,000 people that lived on the island. 100,000 fled to Japan in boats. Those people are still living in Japan to this day. And many others were imprisoned and ultimately died in prison. By 1949, there was active guerrilla warfare going on throughout South Korea and southern part of what became North Korea in continued protest against this U.S. occupation. By then, the Russian troops were out completely. Actually, when the U.S. troops came in 1950, the United States military wasn't really aware that there was a civil war going on, a guerrilla war that we were thrust into the middle of. And Nogun Rhee, some of you may remember reading about Nogun Rhee, a story that the AP uncovered in 1999 about the massacre by U.S. soldiers at Nogun Rhee at this railroad viaduct. Well, that investigation has unleashed a concept called Han in Korea. Han is deeply repressed rage about things that have happened in the past that people haven't dared talk about for fear of repression against themselves. Now we know that there's been 300 massacre sites, and we don't know how many more are going to be known as people begin talking about what happened in 1948, 49, 50, and 51 all over South Korea. Anybody that was not explicitly a supporter of Syngman Rhee was considered suspect and was put on a registry list. Between 1947 and 1950, we now think somewhere between 550,000 and a million South Koreans were murdered. People, Koreans who were in some way actively identified as opposing the U.S. occupation and the Syngman Rhee regime. And then I found out that by the end of the Korean War, 4 million Koreans had been killed and 1 million Chinese. And Korea was the only country in that part of Asia that had never actually invaded another country. And I thought, what an ironic twist that the only country that was not an aggressor nation was divided as a result of World War II and remains divided in 2003. So in a sense, I would say that Korea can teach us a lot by examining this history of our intervention in Korea. The Koreans can teach us a lot. By the way, since Han has been unleashed, this liberation of this repressed rage, everywhere people are starting to talk about their history in Korea. They're talking about what happened in 1945, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50 that they did not dare talk about. 1951, 52. Why was there a Korean War? Why did we decide June 25th was the start of the war? Why hadn't we talked about Syngman Rhee's incursions into the north over 12 or 1,400 times in 1949 and 50? When you go to South Korea today, you'll notice on the Armed Forces channel every day they have warnings for tourists, places to avoid for that day. Places to avoid are where there are expected demonstrations by Koreans against U.S. military presence in Korea. And then, of course, I look at that so I know where I am going to go. And you will see thousands of students, in some cases thousands of students, demonstrating in front of the bases. with big signs in English, U.S. troops out of Korea. That's for the Western press. And now you have the history books in Korea itself beginning to be uncensored. They've had as much of a censored version of history as we have here. And then you had the U.S. armored personnel carrier that ran over two Korean girls and killed them, for which the soldiers were exonerated. All of this produces a kind of convergence of energy in South Korea to get the U.S. out. And the solution to this Korean problem is very simple. And if it wasn't for the complication of U.S. politics, it would be resolved in a day. All the North Koreans want is a peace treaty. The Korean War ended with an armistice, cessation of hostilities pending a peace treaty. The peace talks were to go on in Panmunjom. Panmunjom still has the building where the talks went on until 1992. There's a yellow line halfway bisecting the building. Chairs on one side of the line, chairs on the other side of the line. North Koreans would sit on one side, representatives of the United States on the other side. They haven't met for 10 years or 11 years. But all North Korea wants is a peace treaty. I've traveled all over North Korea, as well as I have South Korea. I've talked with hundreds, if not thousands, of people, always with a translator, of course. But you know, they're people just like us. They laugh, they cry. They want security. They want peace. They don't want to fear when they're going to be bombed again. During the Korean War, one-third of all the population in North Korea was killed. One of the highest percentages of deaths in the history of the world, warfare. Everybody you meet in North Korea, everybody I've met in North Korea, everybody without exception, lost one or a dozen or 20 family members, and they can start talking about who in their family died in the bombings. It's a scar. I believe that since it's such a critical issue in contemporary political terms, the issue of Korea, and it really most people in the West don't understand this history, this assault on the Korean psyche. And maybe people will recognize that there's a lot of pieces of history that have been assaultive that come back to us.
Vietnam veteran Brian Wilson speaking recently in California. He was recorded by Dave Adelson and the LA Sound Posse. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Chauffard. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.